Chapter 22. Problems, Plagiarism, Probation, Missions, and Missionaries. What I do ye know not now, but shall know hereafter. Mary Baker Eddy. 1895. The publication of the manual was only one of the numerous problems demanding the leader's attention. Even with all the rules and bylaws, Mrs. Eddy still had to watch and guide every move of her church. Though she encouraged her students to independent action, more often than not, she had to correct their mistakes and settle their disputes for the progress, honor, and defense of her cause. To keep them from worshiping their new temple in place of worshiping in it, she had instructed the directors to open the church to visitors on only one day of the week. Later, when the first members voted to discontinue services for an August vacation, they received a correction from the leader. Please read this in meeting. When you voted to adjourn all the meetings 1 month, you should also have voted to close the church building to all visitors during that month. Our master asked, "Which is greater, the temple or the gift that sanctifieth the temple?" Students at that time have recorded that Foster Eddy teased his mother until she made him first reader. But there was far greater depth to her action than that simple statement implies. Her interesting letter of September 23rd to the directors contains hints as well as recommendations. "I have accepted, after serious consideration, the resignation of Mr. E.P. Bates as a member of your board, dated August 30th, 1895. I also recommend that you elect Judge S.J. Hanna to fill the vacancy. Also, I recommend that you elect Dr. Foster Eddy for the first reader of our church. God bids me fulfill the command in the sermon of our master to all Christians. I ask dear Mr. Bates to give this example to the church, and then God will take care of the rest, and the wrath of man will praise him, and the remaining wrath he will restrain. The vote on the time for offices to expire must first be taken at a special church meeting. I have notified Johnson. Then you can elect as above, and show yourselves followers of Christ's command. Please say to Mr. Bates that I especially request him to nominate Dr. Foster Eddy for first reader, and have it voted on before his resignation is accepted by the board. Please let me hear immediately from your board. Quote, what I do ye know not now, but shall know hereafter." End quote. Perhaps she knew in advance what the outcome of this move would be, and was letting her students learn by experience. Be that as it may, Judge Hanna replaced Bates on the board of directors as of October 1st. And at the annual meeting held on that date, it was announced that Dr. Foster Eddy had been elected first reader. All other church officers remained the same, including Bates, who had been re-elected president at Mrs. Eddy's request. The members who attended the annual meeting on the 1st of October in 1895 were disappointed at not hearing a final report from the treasurer of the building fund of the Mother Church. This may have occasioned the other director's questioning of Stephen Chase's accounts and Mrs. Eddy's response of October 8. Please read this to the full board. Mr. Chase is a precious Christian Scientist. He is my student, and I see no cause for auditing his accounts. But if a fight is waged because of my confidence in him, you have the bylaws of our church, and the church, not I, must settle this question. At a later date, when the directors wanted to remove Mr. Chase from office, Mrs. Eddy told Calvin C. Hill about the dispute and asked his opinion. I said, "I believe that he is the most honest one of the whole lot." Mrs. Eddy then closed one hand and with a wide sweep placed it in the other hand, saying as she did so, quote, "I would bank my life on Stephen A. Chase," end quote. It may have been in defense of Mr. Chase that she wrote the letter to the Mother Church, Miscellaneous Writings, page 129, wherein she states, "If our board of directors is prepared to itemize a report of the first financial year since the erection of the edifice of the First Church of Christ Scientist, let it do so. Otherwise, I recommend that you waive the church bylaw relating to finances this year of your first fruits. This board did not act under that bylaw. It was not in existence all of the year. It is but just to consider the great struggles with perplexities and difficulties which the directors encountered in Anno Domini 1894, and which they have overcome. May God give unto us all that loving sense of gratitude which delights in the opportunity to cancel accounts. After this financial year, when you call on the members of the Christian Science Board of Directors to itemize or audit their accounts, these will be found already itemized and last year's records immortalized with perils past and victories won. In later years, Mr. Bates was more charitable with the directors than they were with Stephen Chase in 1895. He wrote in retrospect about the great struggles, quote, which the directors encountered in Anno Domini 1894. Lest any person reading this brief history think that the board of directors was negligent in their duty in regard to building the Mother Church, I desire to put them right. I was thankful that the board of directors lived to attend to the dedication of the church. Students less qualified in Christian Science might not have withstood the attacks which were directed against those gentlemen. It must be remembered that none of the directors had much experience in building or in handling large bodies of men, and the matter of building the Mother Church was entirely out of their line. They probably, with Mrs. Eddy's demonstration, could have carried on the work if they had been allowed to do so by the malpractitioners. Everything they undertook to do was thwarted, if possible. Constantly, they had to work for themselves in Christian Science in order to exist. I came to Boston an unknown quantity to the malpractitioners. I slipped into the church almost unobserved, and while I had 7 weeks of very difficult work I suffered very little physically and was enabled to do the work which the directors wished to do. Consequently, I was freed from observations and attacks, which, if it had been known I was there, might have laid upon me a heavy load. Probably no author in the history of the world has had his writings so plagiarized as have been the writings of Mary Baker Eddy. And with no other author has the word plagiarism been as misunderstood and misinterpreted. The word plagiarize, which means to steal or purloin and pass off as one's own, is derived from the Greek plagios, meaning oblique, crooked, and from the Latin plagiarius, meaning kidnapper. To grasp an idea from the writings or speech of another and to expand upon it is not plagiarism. Everyone assimilates the thoughts, ideas, and even the vocabulary of those with whom he associates. In the case of thinkers, scholars, and writers, this is enlarged to the works that they peruse and study. A thorough analysis of any author's works would reveal what might be called borrowing from other authors. But this is not plagiarism, unless there is criminal intent to steal. The more extensive an author's reading, studying, and writing, the more extensive is his borrowing. Sometimes he is aware of the source of his expression, but more often he is not. He is much like a traveler on a road who, seeing a signpost, accepts and follows its directions, assimilating and using them, while giving no thought to who first traveled this road or who made the signpost. From the foundation of the world, no one, save Jesus of Nazareth, has been as maliciously maligned and falsely accused as has been Mary Baker Eddy. The intent is to destroy the little book, which she got from the hand of the angel. And so the enemies of Christ shout plagiarist at God's anointed witness. But her writings are so hopelessly original that it is difficult to find even the normal borrowing in her works. However, one of the more than 10, and most probably between 20 and 50 thousand letters she wrote, included a signpost that she had assimilated in her childhood, and critics have ballooned this one letter, this less than 1/10,000th of her letters, as plagiarism, while completely disregarding the total originality of numerous books, sermons, articles, poems, and hymns, and of her masterpiece, Science and Health. In retrospection and introspection, Mrs. Eddy says, quote, "At 10 years of age, I was as familiar with Linley Murray's grammar as with the Westminster Catechism, and the latter I had to repeat every Sunday." End quote. So it was some time prior to 1831, when she was 10 years of age, that little Mary had assimilated a signpost in Linley Murray's grammar about the man of integrity. 64 years later, in the fall of 1895, in a letter to the first members, she asked, quote, "Do you meet in unity, preferring one another? Do you manifest love, for those that hate you and despitefully use you?" End quote. Then she described the man of integrity so deeply embedded in her consciousness. At the time of this letter, the leader said to Clara Shannon, quote, "That is a portrait of Ira O. Knapp," end quote. It is altogether possible that she had completely forgotten reading those words, for this is not an uncommon experience for authors. When the Atlantic Monthly magazine apprised James Russell Lowell that a poem he submitted had a startling resemblance to one of Mrs. Aiken, which she had published in May of 1866, the poet located the two-year-old issue and responded, quote, "I was astonished at your mildness. You should have cried, 'Stop, thief.' I had utterly forgotten the confounded woman's verses," end quote. Josephine Woodbury was not the only person admitted on a probationary basis before being accepted as a member of the Mother Church, but there is little doubt that she was the most troublesome. And it could hardly be said that the first members had the compassionate desire for her reform that the leader had. At Mrs. Eddy's insistence, they had opened their doors to Mrs. Woodbury, but not their hearts. The odium of the Immaculate Conception publicity, the Pool of Bethesda baptism, the abode of the prince, were all very much in their thoughts and on their tongues. 6 months of her probationary year had barely elapsed when Mrs. Woodbury stood up in the Friday evening meeting of October 25th and spoke at great length. She may have felt the contrition of the Magdalene in Mrs. Eddy's presence, but it did not remain with her when surrounded by her credulous disciples. Their adulation emboldened deceitfulness, and the integrity calling for reform deserted her. The tone of her lengthy speech was entirely one of self-justification. The first members were outraged. They met the following Monday and dropped Josephine Woodbury from probationary membership. And they felt perfectly justified in their action, though they could not claim that their motive was to reform the sinner nor to lead her to repentance. Once again, the whole problem was pushed onto Mrs. Eddy's shoulders. The Woodbury situation was only one of the problems thrust upon the leader in October. Foster Eddy read as first reader of the Mother Church for one Sunday and resigned. On Thursday, October 10th, Mrs. Eddy wrote to Mr. Johnson, "First business of your church meeting is to adopt the enclosed bylaws. Then close the meeting by adjourning to meet in Concord at my house the same day, October 13th, and afterwards in Boston. Bring all the members but Dr. Foster Eddy with you. He cannot come. Note well, I charge you to say nothing of this last till your meeting convenes. If the circumstances admit of any change in this program, I will let you know in time." In imitation of her leader, Augusta Stetson had moved to adopt her young protege, Carol Norton, whom she considered her spiritual heir, that she might make him her legal heir. But Mrs. Eddy advised against the adoption, so Augusta abandoned the idea. In November, the leader wrote to Mrs. Stetson, "Do you know what has been saved by avoiding the relationship you contemplated? A child is apt to feel there is no one so little to be obeyed, feared, or reverenced as his mother. If this error gets possession of him, there is nothing on earth for a mother quite as sharp in its anguish to bear. This you have been spared." It may have been the publication of Mrs. Mary Bennett Duke's letter from Kobe, Japan, in the September Journal that caused Mrs. Eddy to publish her letter of correction previously written to this eager new convert to Christian Science. The Dukeses were Christian missionaries who had recently been introduced to science and health and had welcomed it with open arms. The leader's letter is self-explanatory. July 30th, 1895. "My dear Mrs. Dukes, I have received your book duly, but regret exceedingly that you have published such a work. While I do not question your Christian motives in doing so, I know the result will not be favorable to the end in view. You have no premises in Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, or any of my writings, whence to draw such hyperbolical conclusions on human wedlock. Now, my dear sister in Christ, I advise you to stop the circulation of your book, and at this period not to inculcate such radical views on marriage. Had I seen your manuscript, I should have advised you not to publish it. Let us wait on God. He will prepare the thoughts and minds of men for whatever he has to reveal. Remember that I do not encourage, without mutual consent, the idea of a husband or a wife abolishing the marriage relations that are not violated. The scripture saith, quote, my grace is sufficient for you, end quote. May divine love replenish your faith and understanding and guide your footsteps in the paths of his testimony, giving you wisdom, success, and sweet peace in your missionary labors. Truly and affectionately, Mary Baker Eddy." This topic had been met 6 years earlier, and the leader's advice published in the June Journal for 1889. It could be summed up in the one sentence, quote, "I say let other people's marriage relations alone. Two persons only should be found within their precincts," end quote. But missions and missionaries were subjects of concern in 1895. Laura Sargent was appointed an interesting mission in the fall of this year, and that was to care for the mother's room on the one day of the week that it was open to visitors. But the mission of the mother, the founder of Christian Science, was very unlike the general conception of this Christian activity at that time. Her mission could best be likened to that of Jesus in his words, quote, "I am not sent, but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel," end quote. And as Jesus, it was founded upon healing. Consequently, the missionaries she sent to the cities and nations of Israel were healers, as were Jesus' disciples. Article 9 in the forthcoming manual was entitled Board of Missionaries and was one of the changes that demanded last-minute revision. In its amended form, it read, "The first members shall elect annually a Christian Science Board of Missionaries, to supply sections that have no local healers or teachers in Christian Science. This board is limited to no special number. These missionaries shall be paid by contributions from individuals, from the church, and from the funds of the publishing society. Their missionary stations shall be appointed by a committee of the first members, and the duty of this committee shall be to learn what sections are destitute and to supply them with tried, faithful, loyal healers and teachers. The activities of the church in the missionary field needed this bylaw, as is evident from Mrs. Eddy's letter of October 23rd to the CS directors. I want you to meet tomorrow a.m. and appoint Dr. Foster Eddy the mission to fill immediately the vacancy in Philadelphia. Miss Anna Osgood has left, and it is a most important post to hold and have strongly guarded. With love, Mother Mary Baker Eddy. Send missionaries to only destitute places, and recall all others sent into other fields, and change the bylaw at your next meeting to read thus, so you will not again break an important bylaw. Oh, when and how long, O Lord, how long? I cannot carry this church, or in other words, I will not, unless the members do better. With love, Mother, M. B. Eddy. Note well, do not do such an outrage as to appoint a missionary that you do not know well. The directors may have appointed Foster Eddy to the mission immediately as requested, but it was the following August before he finally left Boston for Philadelphia. Nevertheless, the responsibility of first reader fell upon Judge Hannah once more. To make it official and to relieve the judge of some of his duties, the leader sent a telegram to Joseph Armstrong on October 28th, stating, quote, "Make Judge Hannah first reader and Albert Metcalf director," end quote. An article in the Journal for May 1895 entitled "The Organ Concert" told of a musical evening which had been held at the Mother Church on Thursday, March 21st, where few Christian Scientists were in attendance. The concert was under the management of the Friend and Vati Organ Company of Detroit, Michigan, and the article went on to explain, "The chief purpose of the concert was to exhibit the organ to the musical people and organ lovers of Boston, as it is the first of the kind to be introduced into this city. A large audience embracing many of Boston's most noted musicians graced the occasion and listened with delight to Mr. Woodman's masterful execution of his favorite instrument. He was frequently and enthusiastically applauded." Following several pages of description of the evening, the program and the organ, the concluding paragraph began, "We have heretofore said that this organ was the munificent gift of a single scientist, who took that means in part of expressing his gratitude for the marvelous healing of his wife through Christian Science. It was his wish that his name should be withheld, but we think that the time has come when silence is no longer golden, and hence we take the liberty of saying that Mr. Albert Metcalf of West Newton, Massachusetts, treasurer of the Denison Manufacturing Company, is the generous donor. Albert Metcalf had become an earnest student of Christian Science, but he did not replace Hannah on the board. Mrs. Eddy's letter of October 30th to the directors is explanatory. I was told by a student that Mr. Metcalf was a member of our church. I hope, as it now is situated, that Judge Hannah will remain on the board. The only reason that I named a substitute in case of vacancy was that he had so many offices already. Judge Hannah was conscientious in fulfilling the duties of his many offices and begged to be relieved of the directorship so early in November. The faithful and dedicated William B. Johnson replaced Hannah and remained on the board for many more years. The manual, which was the rod Mrs. Eddy had so needed for guiding her church, was constantly in a state of revision as the demands and exigencies of each day presented themselves. Early in December, Mrs. Eddy requested the first members to amend a bylaw, stating in her letter, "You have already reaped the good result of executing the Stern bylaw in Article 6, Section 3. It has relieved you of a large portion of the plottings and machinations to destroy the unity of your church. But I foresee the danger of a future possible misuse and abuse of this uncompromising bylaw. I am led to request this amendment that we may never knowingly deprive a single mortal of a single hope that may be an incentive to his reformation, or involve at present a precedent for settling the question of mental malpractice." The reference to the bylaw, to machinations, reformation, and mental malpractice may have been prompted by Mrs. Woodbury's activities, but whether or no, neither the church nor Mrs. Eddy had seen the last of Josephine Woodbury. The guidance, encouragement, instruction, and correction necessary for her sincere, loyal students kept Mrs. Eddy more than busy 7 days a week. Her letter of December 11th to the board of directors was one of correction. "I said in the first place that the painting of the chair should not be itinerant, nor placed in the vestibule, but placed permanently in the auditorium or in Mother's room. The present arrangement is malicious animal magnetism, giving another occasion for saying, quote, personal worship of Mrs. Eddy, end quote. Pulling it up and down for exhibition is enough to make people say you are gone wild on Mother, and the church is turned into a theater. While the fact is, if you loved Mother, you would keep her commandments. It destroys the dignity of the history associated with the chair to twaddle it up and down the walls." There was a history far more important than that of the chair Mrs. Eddy sat in while writing Science and Health. And during the year 1895, one of her students became deeply involved in researching and writing this important history. The December Journal, in telling of the erection of another new Christian Science church, stated, "Its locus is in the large and important city of St. Louis. Its erection is the result, in part at least, of the labors of Mrs. Julia Field King, aided by her faithful band of students. The new church edifice was not the only mission of the scholarly and capable Mrs. King, since she had left the editorship of the journal in 1892. At the time of her appointment as editor, Mrs. Eddy had written to Mr. Johnson, "Last Friday, the very student of mine whom 2 years ago I tried to get for editor of our journal came to me wholly unexpectedly, saying, 'I will take this charge.' She did not know why she came to me until I told her our need. She is the one, or I am mistaken. She is a thorough scholar and will need no assistance." What Mrs. King did need to learn was that the discoverer and founder was guided by God in all that she did, and this is a hard lesson for intellectuality. This point was no doubt also the cause of her hasty resignation, for obedience and humility are also hard lessons for the competent and talented person of achievement. The discoverer had had hard lessons all her early years, until she had become totally submissive to God. These severe experiences changed but did not cease as the founder learned of God the way to fulfill her mission. In her close relationship with the leader during her months as editor, Mrs. King had faintly perceived the divinity in Mrs. Eddy's life and work. This perception increased as she taught and practiced Christian Science back in St. Louis, causing her to vacillate between true obedience and adulation. But it also caused her to embark upon an undertaking for which few were so well qualified as was she. This scholarly pursuit was tracing the genealogy of Mary Baker Eddy, which led to an enlarged understanding of God's people Israel. It may have been Mrs. King who brought Professor C.A.L. Totten's writings on race to Mrs. Eddy's attention. The leader has made some interesting comments on Professor Totten's work, which should guide any student in his pursuit of the subject. In an essay entitled The Second Advent, she wrote, "C.A.L. Totten, USA, in his excellent work, The King's Daughter, writes, quote, 'It was the creation of womanhood that completed the equation, which even yet we have not fully solved.'" End quote. His prophecies are grounded in science. They reiterate the sacred scriptural records and the logical syllogism in Science and Health, where the demonstration of being starts with the manhood of being and rises to womanhood as the Christ idea and the Revelator's vision thereof, wherein the Spirit and the Bride say, "Come." In March of 1895, Mrs. Eddy had written to Mrs. King to direct the thought to General Totten's grand publications without forearming it with the facts laid down in mine would be as unwise as to talk materia medica and surgery to a patient you were healing of a compound fracture of the bone. A whole book could be devoted to this project of Mrs. King and the related correspondence between her and the leader, but Mrs. Eddy's letter of March 1st, quoted above, gives a glimpse of this work. How mother loves you as she reads your last letter and perceives the experienced woman and the babe in Christ combining. How natural that the babe should be fretted with the friction of material history and the error it includes, and must go to mother for the milk of the word and rest on the bosom of God. Mother has felt all this and a million more struggles for 30 years, and walked in the straight and narrow path, which lies between harming others and helping them. Giving milk to babes and meat to men requires great wisdom, great growth, great love. To lead the world wisely means much. Hence, Jesus' words, quote, "Be ye therefore wise as serpents," end quote. To direct the thought of General Totten's grand publications without forearming it with the facts laid down in mind, also the recital of your own experience as referred to in your letter to me, would be as unwise as to talk materia medica and surgery to a patient you were healing of a compound fracture of the bone. Search up the history you are upon the verge of discovering, fairly and clearly, and write it wisely. Then send it for publication in the Christian Science Journal, and if it is received favorably there, publish it in pamphlet form. The history Mrs. King was on the verge of discovering was contained in one sentence in her letter to Mrs. Eddy of March 15th, quote, "There is on the way from the Smithsonian Institute and the great Peabody Library the full proof of your direct descent from David," end quote. But Mrs. Eddy's letter, written 2 days earlier, reverted to the absolute truth. I think it is not wise to further pursue your chronological research. It is not really in the line of truth that the thought is proving itself in this investigation, but in the line of material origin, and this has an end. Now I would turn away from the subject. My reason for asking you to undertake this historical proof was that the people would sooner be convinced, perhaps by it, of my legitimate mission. But I fear it costs you too much to direct your thought so materially, and the end will not justify the means. Later in March, she wrote, quote, "You may go forward now if it costs you no spiritual loss, as you assure me," end quote. And for the next 4 months, the project was on again, off again. In one letter, the leader wrote, "A feeling of sweet submission has come over me, a sense of thy will be done. And I have conquered the reluctance I felt to have what I knew was true proven. But, dear one, you deserve the place you have earned, namely, the historian of what will thrill the people. And God gave you to me, no doubt, for this very end, and I have stood for you and by you against fearful odds, no doubt, for this very end." A letter from Mrs. Eddy in mid-July, when the work was nearing completion, stated, quote, "Your present arrangement must be changed before it will do to publish it. As it is, it would do more harm than good to our cause," end quote. The extensive research she had done was causing Mrs. King to give more credence to material descent than to the spiritual facts of being. So on July 23rd, the leader terminated the project. Now, do not make a single more research into my genealogy. You have all I want. Just type the whole as you named, and that is all I shall allow to be historic. I do see that it is wrong to pursue the material thought of the dead as having life or of matter kinship, for there is none. Only think of the descent as that of a name. No inherent qualities of race exist. Banish this lie from your mind, or it will harm you. Mind strictly what I say. I read the thought looking at your fingers. Fix it up and send with no more labor over it. It is all a liar from the beginning, and truth abides not in it. You need truth. The lie seems more real to you than to me. Hence the result above named. 10 years earlier, when Augusta Stetson had asked Mrs. Eddy why she had not come to reading, the leader had responded, quote, "I was there," end quote, when everyone believed she was at home. In this letter, she is saying the same thing to Julia Field King, quote, "I read the thought looking at your fingers," end quote. But the main point to be learned from this letter is the ultimate truth about race. Like all animal magnetism, it must first be seen and understood, and then its existence utterly denied. Unseen and undenied, it seems to hold sway. The leader is recorded as having said, quote, "To my view, the idea of race is superior to the idea of sex," end quote. In other words, it must be seen and understood. The ultimate denial she gave to Mrs. King, quote, "No inherent qualities of race exist," end quote. The following day, God terminated the project, for only mind could have caused Mrs. Eddy to send the telegram to Mrs. King, which she sent on July 24th. "Send manuscript, just as it is, to me at once. It will not be published." Mrs. King was immediate, obedient, and humble in her response. Her reply of July 25th caused Mrs. Eddy to pen on the back of her letter, quote, "Precious, obedient child." This she wrote after all her labor to get out the facts material of my lineage and with the expectation of publishing them. "And I then declined to let the work be published now." What an example is this for some of my other students, end quote. Mrs. Eddy's emphasis of the word now in the note she wrote on the reverse of Mrs. King's letter is of interest. Her reply to Mrs. King also implies that the project may have a future. "Your prompt obedience, so intelligent, simple, wise, almost surprises one who has so long waited, worked, and suffered to gain this growth for her students. You have been benefited. I have been satisfied. The world will sometime reap the reward of your labor, and you shall be announced as the author of the little work, if ever it is made public." With all her ability, Mrs. King seems to have been restless. In early journals, we find her listed first in Kirksville, Missouri, and then for nearly 2 years in Seattle, Washington. For much of the year following her resignation as editor of the journal, she was listed in Boston and next back in St. Louis, Missouri. No doubt, Mrs. Eddy perceived the conflict in Mrs. King's character when she wrote, quote, "I have stood for you and by you against fearful odds," end quote. But she was equally aware of her remarkable ability and of her spiritual growth at being able to sacrifice graciously her work of many, many months on the altar of obedience. Perhaps the mission next entrusted to Mrs. King was acknowledgement and reward for her labor and her progress. When the call came early in 1896 for a teacher in London, the missionary Mrs. Eddy sent to this field in England was Julia Field King.